Chapter 23. Harzwi is a huge, largely aquatic planet. The vast stretches of marsh broken by small settlements built high above the ground on stilts, deep oceans, and steep, forest-covered mountains that rise high above the rest of the terrain. It's nowhere John has been before, because he's always kept mostly to Republic space, but he can feel it as soon as they drop out of hyperspace, a heady, heavy thrum of awareness and interconnected life. It makes his breath catch, and he leans forward between the pilot's seats before he can stop himself, fingers digging into the fabric. "John?" Arla asks, sharp, but John shakes his head to cut her worry short. "It's a force nexus," he says. "The whole planet. It's been a long time since I felt one so bright." He takes a breath, letting his attention settle, slips past the overwhelming press of Harzwi itself, and closes his eyes. Reaches and, this is the right place. He knows that without an ounce of doubt. There, like a sweet, low note against Harzwi's symphony, just slightly out of place, is another hum, full of grief and anger. John can feel it in his bones, as heady as a long fall, and he breathes out, lets his eyes slide open. "The Darksaber is here," he says. "I can feel it." Django grunts, pleased, and slides out of his seat, letting Ursa slip into it in his place. "Good. This is the last time that bastard is going to have it," he says. "Still up for this, Countess?" Ursa nods determinedly, leaning forward to key on the comm and accept the pending priority transmission. "Air Control, this is Countess Ursa Wren of Clan Wren," she says. "I'm here to visit the memorial to Mandalore the Binder." "Greetings, Countess," a woman answers, smooth. "Your access codes, please." Nerves flickering tangibly, Ursa inputs them, then sits back, and John can feel her fear, her wavering sort of anger that has roots in protectiveness, her doubt. "It's all right," he says, quiet, because there's no sense of immediate threat. They don't suspect anything. Ursa casts him a startled glance, then nods, taking a breath. Just as she turns back to the comm, the transmission buzzes to life again, and the woman says, "You're cleared to land. Welcome to Harzwi, Countess." "Thank you, Air Control," Ursa says, and ends the transmission, sinking back in the chair with a grimace. Her gauntlets curl tight around her head, and she says to Arla, "The memorial is right at the base of the hills where the fortress sits. We can make our way up from there." "I've got the location," Arla says, checking her navigation computer. "Down we go. Nobody breathes suspiciously or they'll shoot us out of the air." There's still no sense of danger, so John ignores the warning, most of his attention focused on the curve where the hills rise from the swamp. An iron-gray structure, tall and looming, is built back into the earth, with a view of every approach to it that an enemy might use, and Django whistles, low and impressed, as they glide past its long shadow. "The Crusaders knew what they were doing," he says. "We're going to have to wait for full dark to get up there." Ursa shakes her head. "There's no full dark on this side of Harzwi," she corrects. "Not at this time of year. The closest it gets is twilight, and that won't be for almost a week." "Great," Arla mutters, and she slants a look at John. "Can you work your JT magic and get us up there?" "It's not magic," John says. But he considers the distance, then breathes out, listening to the pull of the Force. That bright, sad note is a tether, drawing him inexorably towards the fortress, and it's hard to consider the how when all he wants is to move. There's a pause, and then Django asks, faintly wary, "John?" Teleporting multiple people is too risky, and John won't attempt it, even for this. But there's another way up. John wouldn't be pulled so readily if there wasn't. He sweeps a look over the surrounding marsh, then leans forward, watching the array of tall stones that are approaching. "Countess, Do people paying their respects ever go up the hill? Ursa blinks, startled, and frowns. Maybe? My mother mentioned coming here before, to pay respects, but it's my first time. I think there's supposed to be a rug weavers collective near the monument, though. Mandalore the Binder was a rug weaver, Arla says, eyes on the readouts as the ship descends the last few hundred meters towards landing pads built above the marsh. It's probably his clan still, if they're allowed to live so close. Conquered Dawn has a monument like that to Mandalore the Diligent, and his descendants still keep the lands. Most of what John knows about Harzwi is related to its weavers and their exports, and he frowns faintly. There has to be some way for them to continue their trade with the Republic, even while the Death Watch is in charge of the planet, and Tor is the very furthest thing from friendly to the Republic, given his open calls to invade and conquer it. Harzwi rugs are still a revered luxury in wealthy places, though, and John hasn't heard of any smugglers running them. That means there's some way to get goods off Harzwi, even with Tor opposed, and the weavers are the most likely to know how to avoid the fortress and its sensors. We should meet them, John says, and shifts back, sliding around Django's bulk to drop down the ladder to the main area of the ship. His cloak is draped over a chair, and he pulls it on, flips the hood up just as heavy armor thuds to the deck. I'll come with you, Ursa says firmly. People will know the Mandalore's children, and that Tor wants them dead or captured, but I'm allowed to be here. John considers her for a moment. You would trust a Jedi to have your back? He asks quietly. Ursa slants him a look, then deliberately pulls her helmet on. You're not just a Jedi, you're also the Mandalore's husband, she counters. Hesitates, and then says, Jaster Mareel has honor. Even his enemies know that. I don't think he'd marry someone without it. With a clatter, Django slides down the ladder, frowning. We'll keep watch from the ship, he tells John. If you find a way up, calm us. The Death Watch is probably monitoring transmissions, but you can pretend to be a tourist or something. John doesn't roll his eyes, though it's tempting. He's been doing undercover missions since he could first touch the Force reliably, and he understands perfectly well how to operate when being observed. I'm part of the Bounty Hunters Guild, if you need to introduce me, he tells Ursa quietly, under the same name. Ursa pauses, surprise flickering. No one connects the Jedi and the Bounty Hunter with the same name, she asks, bemused. Lots of people named Antilles in the universe, Arla puts in, perched at the edge of the cockpit. It's one of the most common human or near-human names, and I've met maybe 100 Johns. Bweer. John winces, and Django makes a sound like he's gagging. Arla ignores them both, perfectly unbothered. Bweer, signal us if you find anything. Django and I can keep to the trees and make our way around, even if it's slow going. All right, John says, because anything that gets him out of this conversation is acceptable. Countess, are you ready? Ursa nods, holstering her blasters and heading toward the ramp with steady strides. John falls in beside her, drawing himself up a little straighter, shifting his posture to make himself more imposing, his stride, his bearing. As the ramp descends, he spots a woman in armor, lounging and looking close to sleep but vividly attentive, near the edge of the closest building. In the red armor, she's on watch, he murmurs to Ursa, and feels the turn of her consternation. More audibly, he says, You're sure you want to visit the memorial now, Countess? He can feel Ursa catch on in an instant, the flicker of nerves and thrill, and then a careful reining in of her reaction. I told you, she says, not pitched to carry, but still clear enough that the Death Watch woman will overhear it. Mandalore the Binder was famous for his loyalty. I just want to sit and think for a bit, somewhere his spirit might reach me. Of course, Countess, John demurs. And then they're past the woman and heading up the wide walkways over the marsh. John doesn't turn to look back, but he can feel the woman's sharpness, her assessment, the turn of her attention towards her calm. She's sending a message to someone, he says, almost soundless. There must have been orders to watch you. Ursa's nervousness rises again, edged with something grim. Tor trusts my clan, she says, equally soft but threaded with steel. But even he has to know that leaving us to be executed as oathbreakers for betraying an offer of hospitality would make any clan head think twice about following him. It didn't stop him from doing it, John thinks, but instead of saying as much, he sweeps a look ahead of them, spots at least one other Mandalorian in armor who's paying close attention to their path. The man isn't making any move to approach, though, and when Ursa passes without hesitation, headed straight for the foot of the hills where they rise from the marsh, he watches but doesn't try to follow. John tracks his path back towards the opposite side of the port, then focuses elsewhere. That man doesn't feel important, but their destination does. Was Mandalore the Binder really known for his loyalty? He asks, quiet enough not to carry, and Ursa nods shortly. My mother would come here whenever she was struggling with her ties to House Vizsla, or when she was having problems with one of our vassal clans, she answers. It never appealed to me, though, and after she died and Tor took over the fortress here, I never bothered. She steals a glance up the hill, tension twisting up through her, and says quietly, Mandalore the Binder was born right after the fall of the Crusaders and Revan's takeover. When Revan died, he protected the last of the Tong and helped them settle among the human clans. All the bonds he forged were built on loyalty to each other as Mandalorians. Like Jaster, uniting the clans and houses in respect for the past and a shared moral code. John can't help but smile a little, thinking of Jaster's reaction to the comparison, but when he drags his attention back to the present, it's to the weight of Ursa's gaze on him. It makes him pause, not entirely sure what to do with that focused sort of attention. Is something wrong? He asks, a little awkwardly. Ursa looks away again, hesitating. Then, careful, she says, My family has a lot of stories about Revan. We weren't sworn to House Vizsla until after Tare's reign, but my ancestors served Revan after he defeated Mandalore the Ultimate. This feels like the sort of thing Fae or Dark Woman would be able to answer more easily than John. He hesitates for a moment, watching the sleek lines of a stone monument appear over the treetops as they pass into the marsh itself, and then says, Revan is complicated, to the Jedi. Wry humor flickers, and Ursa snorts. He's complicated for Mandalorians, too, she says. You're not much like him, are you, as a Jedi? It takes John several long seconds to formulate an answer. No is the simplest one, but not entirely correct. Revan betrayed the Jedi multiple times, became a Sith Lord, was responsible for thousands of deaths, but Dark Woman always told him. There's a monster inside him, the potential for something vicious and dark and dangerous enough to tear the galaxy apart. A threat, she always said. A threat he had to keep chained, had to be aware of. The sort of thing that meant he shouldn't care for anyone, shouldn't even feel fond of anyone, whether civilians or other Jedi or pets or places. No attachments, no fondness, no weakness. Just the Force. John learned, during his training, about all the Jedi who have fallen in the course of their duties, betrayed the tenets of the Jedi Order, and ruined lives, ruined worlds. Revan found the light again eventually, but he fell too. John grew up with the constant awareness of that fall, like walking a tightrope along the edge of a cliff. One wrong step, one bit of carelessness, and he could be the next Revan. All of John's failures to adhere to Dark Woman's rules seem vivid in this moment. Too clear, too sharp, too vicious. John let himself become fond of Jaster and Miles, of Arla and Jango, of Faye and Nico and Nol. It makes him vulnerable as a Jedi. Weak. Dark Woman has always hated weakness more than anything else in the universe. John, Ursa asks, concerned, and John drags in a breath that feels too small to fill his lungs. I'm more like him than I should be, he says, and that's a weakness too, that admission. But it's the truth. John's always followed the Force. It led him here, to Jaster, to this marriage, to the true Mandalorians in the moment when they needed help. Surely that has to mean something, even if John is weak. Ursa wavers for a second, then reaches out, brushing her fingers over the moss-soft trunk of one of the weeping trees that hangs over the walkway. I always wanted to be like him, she admits, quick, like John is going to judge her for the words. Strong. Strong enough to protect my people and my clan. Revan helped conquer part of the Republic for the Sith, and I thought, if I was more like him, Clan Ren could be strong and win influence with Tor, and then we'd be honorable heroes and everyone would respect us. Everyone would be safe, John thinks she means, though he doesn't press. Just inclines his head and says, "What you're doing right now is more than most would. Going against someone you know did wrong and trying to correct a mistake is its own strength." Revan believed he was correcting the Jedi Order's mistakes when he first joined the fighting. He considers the bright gold of Ursa's armor for a moment and then offers quietly, "Jaster respects you, both for walking into the wedding on your own and for not running afterwards." Jaster hasn't said it outright, but John doesn't need a Jedi's empathy to be able to tell that much. Just the way he treated Ursa and her guards in the aftermath of Aga Kast's attack speaks to his respect. And, John assumes, his hope that Ursa will join the true Mandalorians and abandon her loyalties to the Death Watch. Given where they are right now, John assumes there's a better than decent chance at that, too. Ursa takes a careful breath, but instead of answering, she says quickly, "Up there, that's the memorial." It's easy to spot, given that the walkway they're on ends right at the edge of the rocky foothill. Up the slope a short ways, twin statues of Tong and human soldiers in armor, their faces bare, flank a path of black stones that leads up towards a structure with straight sides and curving beams that take the shape of a roof that's open to the sky. In the center, beneath the crisscrossing beams like spreading threads, there's a dais with a weathered helmet set in the center of it, surrounded by skeins of yarn and thread. A sword is mounted above them, sheath worn but still intact, and intricately woven belts faded but still beautiful. "It's quieter than I thought it would be," Ursa says, frowning, but she heads up the path without hesitation, passing the statues and then stepping into the hall. "My mother said it was always full of people. Where are they all?" "Anywhere that's not near the fortress," a man says, and Ursa jerks around, one hand going to her blaster. John doesn't, because he felt the man's presence, can't sense any hostility now, and he inclines his head briefly. Seated on a mat near one of the open doorways, the man nods back, then shifts aside a small tapestry loom and rises to his feet. He's wearing armor, though lighter than most John has seen, and there's a sniper rifle propped against the wall within reach, though he makes no move to reach for it. Just inclines his head to Ursa and says, "Countess, it's been a while since anyone from Clan Ren was here." Ursa reaches up, pulling her helmet off and tucking it under her arm, her motions careful. "I intended to come before this," she says, faintly stiff. "My mother loved this monument, but there were matters to attend to in the clan and..." The man cocks his head. "Hard to come right after lighting a pyre," he says, and then, before Ursa has to respond, "Normally there would be people to greet you, but there have been a lot of patrols in the port recently, and the clan headed for one of their other camps." "And left you behind?" Ursa asks, frowning deeply. The man smiles, bright. "No, not at all. The warriors of the clan have been taking turns guarding this place so that nothing happens to our ancestors' armor." That makes Ursa relax a little, and she smiles back. "I should have brought something," she says, "but Clan Ren doesn't weave, and I didn't want to offend." She puts a fist to her chest plate and says formally, "Ursa Ren of Clan Ren, it's an honor to meet a descendant of the Binder." The man returns the gesture without pause. "Hoodoo Shiv of Clan Shiv, it's our honor to have you visit, Countess. Did you want to look around on your own, or would you like to have me guide you?" Ursa glances at John, wavers. John looks from her to Hoodoo, then says flatly, "Whatever you would like, Countess, I'm just your guard today." "Guard?" Hoodoo asks, startled, and gives John another look. "You're not Mandalorian, are you?" "By marriage," John says, and doesn't make it a tone that invites further questions. He tugs up his sleeve slightly, showing the edge of Jaster's vambrace, and then carefully pulls it down again. "John Antilles, bounty hunter. The Countess's usual guards were injured recently, and I volunteered." Hoodoo's expression darkens faintly, and he glances at Ursa again, weighs his words for a moment, nearly tangible frustration twisting around him, and then asks carefully, "Was it a training exercise with Tor's people, Countess? Several of our warriors were pulled into training with them, and they needed assistance afterwards." John watches Ursa take a careful, deliberate breath, her fingers curling around her helmet, and she looks away, towards Mandalore the Binder's helmet. "My mother said this was a good place to think," she says instead of answering. "John, you should wait for me outside. I just want to sit in silence for a while." It's an invitation to poke around, so John nods, stepping back. "You're required to stay," he asks Hoodoo. Hoodoo smiles, halfway too apologetic. "It's my duty. If it helps, though, we won't allow any harm to come to people here to pay their respects. Will my weaving disturb you, Countess?" Ursa shakes her head, sinking down to sit cross-legged in front of the helmet. "It may be a few hours," she tells Hem and John equally, and when John glances at her, she meets his eyes with meaning in her gaze. "The edge of the memorial is at the statues of the soldiers near where the hill starts. You can wait there if you want." "Be careful of the squads that wander that way," Hoodoo warns. "They don't like people loitering. If you take the white path back past the edge of the memorial and go up to the tree line, you won't be disturbed, and there's a good view of the place if you're trying to keep an eye on the Countess." The trees run all the way up to the fortress, and while they're not perfect cover, they're more than good enough, particularly if Ursa is willing to stay here and keep attention on herself. John inclines his head, then tells Ursa, "Calm me if you need me," and heads for the far door in the black wall. Outside, different colors of stone line branching paths, and John picks the white one, then heads up its sharp curve as he checks his comm. Arla's channel is easy enough to ping, and he slips into the trees to wait, one eye on the fortress looming above them. The Darksaber is still an audible note, even against Harzwi's bright sort of noise. When John finds a tall tree and leaps up into the branches, just a touch of the force letting him land steadily, the hum brightens sharply, and John closes his eyes and breathes slowly, then reaches for the edges of that grief and anger. There's no mistaking what it is, even if John's never felt that particular force presence before. It feels like a blade, sharp and elegant and wrapped up in a lament, and John brushes the humming notes of that cry. Greed. Greed and avarice and a vicious, grasping sort of glee, full of choking pride and a thread of bitter rage and cowardice. John jerks his senses back with a wince, almost tempted to wipe his hands off on his cloak to erase the clinging miasma of that presence. Not Tor directly, but his afterimage, like the trail of a slug left on otherwise pristine ground. He's had the Darksaber for long enough to leave his mark on it. One more reason to reclaim it, John thinks grimly, and casts a look up the slope. From here, he can see the edge of the fortress, the rising sweep of one wall bursting from sheer stone. An enemy in a jetpack would have to approach from the sky, given the thick forest around the structure, but not a Jedi, John thinks. He touches a hand to the trunk of the tree, closing his eyes as he lets the sense of the forest wash over him. It's an old one, weathered for all its lush, and rooted in a planet that's a nexus in the Force. The sense of the Force twisting up through the roots and branches is stronger than in most places, and John breathes with the trees, the earth here, the currents of wind moving the branches. Getting close under the cover of the forest won't be hard, even in the daylight. And John might not be Fey, but a moment to mind-trick the closest guard into ignoring them, and they can get right into the fortress, then find the Darksaber and retrieve it. Like it can sense his intent, the hum of the Darksaber shifts, steadies. It's still low, a thrumming, heady buzz like Kyber, but noticeably lower, a deep bass note instead of Kyber's sweet alto. The pull of it is a sharp tug behind John's breastbone, urging him onward, and he almost goes, almost heads straight for the fortress without waiting for Jango and Arla. A ping, quiet but still loud enough to break his concentration, and John looks down, finds Arla's response blinking on the readout. There's a number, too. Time until arrival, John thinks, and makes himself breathe, reins himself in. As much as he wants to head straight for the Darksaber, abandoning Arla and Jango in hostile territory is unacceptable. All he has to do is wait, and then the three of them can go together. John's not used to working with other people, or anyone other than Dark Woman on the rare occasions that she needs help, but he thinks of Arla in the aftermath of the mission to rescue Noel, thinks of Django, wounded to the point that it was hard for him to stand, and still putting on armor to go and rescue his sister. Thinks of Jaster and how he hugged both his children when they returned, his relief as bright as a magnesium flare. Breathes out, slow, focused, and closes his eyes, settling back against the tree. He can meditate until Arla and Django get here, try to pinpoint where the Darksaber is, ready the power that he'll need to get them into the fortress. Leaving Django and Arla behind isn't an option, and even if it's fondness, even if it's wrong and unbecoming of a Jedi and weak, John still refuses to abandon them. End of chapter 23.